We're going to have an incredible discussion because we're going to go dark and we're going to go deep, because I've learned that the darker we go, the brighter the light is, easier it is to see.
This is Mike Noriega.
My father, after I mentioned that about the rosaries and what they meant, my father lowered his head. He said, guys, I don't know how we're going to get through this. All I know is I can't get through this without God helping us.
Remember when this happened at Surfside Beach summer of 2021, killing 98 people?
Massive search and rescue operation underway at this hour after the partial collapse of a high-rise condominium building in Surfside, Florida. That's just north of Miami Beach. That's the scene right now. A huge pile of debris down one side of that building. At least one person has been pulled from that rubble, with dozens of emergency crews there now launching a frantic search for other survivors. A chaotic scene that started unfolding in the early morning hours today. And what witnesses are saying, it sounds just horrific.
Well, among them was Mike's grandmother, Hilda Noriega, matriarch of a family whose hearts were broken and shattered that night of this awful tragedy. So this is a story of loss. It's a story of a valley of the shadow of death, a good shepherd, and a God who restores despite the loss and pain that we endure. And although the things we lose and the pain endured are rarely things that can be undone, our Creator finds a way to bring about redemption. This is our hope here on this earth, and many of us hold on to a faith that we still await a redemption of all redemptions, in which all things are reconciled back to this loving Creator. And so we reflect on our divine Savior and our human big brother, who says, in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world.
In the middle of the night, there was 101 people on June 24th, 2021, that went down with the building. There are situations that we're going to run into in life that the only first responder that can show up and rescue us is the name of Jesus himself. A broken heart is a season of grieving that none of us can avoid. If you're going to go through this life, you will go through loss, and there's going to be a grief process attached to that. But a crushed spirit is something entirely different, where you just don't feel like you have any purpose in your existence. How can you allow things to break your heart without them breaking your spirit?
He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for the sake of his name. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me.
See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland.
We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed.
The Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit.
This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In all this, you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or
as a
podcast?
Yeah, just as a person.
No, I like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna lead. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about. All right, well, Mike, good to have you. This obviously isn't a lighthearted conversation, but let our listeners in on a little bit of your background, where you live, and I'd love to hear your faith background as well.
Yeah, so I was actually born in Miami and have grown up in South Florida my entire life. In South Florida, I am the I'm the actual minority because there's very few people that live in South Florida that are actually from South Florida. Because of my mom's faith, she has such an incredible testimony, but she actually brought me to church growing up. And going into my freshman year of high school, I actually had a real encounter with Jesus. And that really changed my life because that youth group that I was involved in, those guys that I grew close friendships with back then became extremely close friends really for the rest of my life. You know, it's been 20, 25 years since then. I think where everything changed for my life, I trusted God at a young age. And so like a lot of Christian guys, I wanted to get married young. And I did. I saved myself for my wedding night. And that's very paramount for my story because I would say about 3.5 years into my marriage, I came home one night and my ex-wife was like, "Hey, I need some space. I'm not happy anymore." And she left that night and never came back.
My God.
And the reason why was because she had an affair. She was having an affair. Caught her. I found out everything. And I really believe you don't know what you're going to do until you're in a situation like that and you're tested. And I wanted to save my marriage, but she was like, "No, I don't want to." And that is the thing that actually led to my book being written later on, because from that point on, for probably about a year and a half following that event, I didn't trust God. I was like, "God, I saved myself. I was obedient to you to encounter this. Your way doesn't work. I don't want to do this with you anymore because your way has just led to me just feeling this brokenness and pain and anguish I've never felt before in my life." And so the only way to describe it is the night that she left me was the day that my heart was broken. The day that of our divorce was the day my spirit was crushed. And there's a huge difference. Eventually, I saw how God was carrying me through everything and he was working all things for my good. And it brought me back to him. But that's probably the biggest part of my story right there was I felt what it felt like to live in the emptiness of a crushed spirit.
Yeah.
And I wrote this book so that nobody ever has to go through what I went through because a broken heart is inevitable, but a crushed spirit, that's something that is optional because what ends up happening is we take a broken heart, which is meant to be a life season, and we turn it into the life sentence of a crushed spirit.
Dang. Now, in relation to your grandma's passing and the gigantic collapse, when did this divorce take place?
So the divorce was in 2013.
Okay.
The collapse was in June of 2021.
Yeah. Man, I do want to hit this question before we even go into the story of the collapsed condo and all of that. And after your divorce, when would you say that you were kind of back on your feet, having worked through a crushed spirit and being restored?
I would say it was about a year and a half for me to work through that. The reason why is because I heard my pastor say it this way. I go to VU Church here in Miami, and I heard Rich Wilkerson Jr. say one time, or I've actually heard him say it many times, is that a dream that hasn't been tested is a dream that can't be trusted. And the truth is that when my faith was tested, it couldn't be trusted because my faith was built on the wrong foundation. See, I had the wrong theology. Romans 8:28, it says that God works all things for the good of those that love him and are called according to his purpose. My interpretation of that verse back then was that if I'm obedient to God, then the situations I go through are going to be good situations because he's going to be looking out for me. He's going to have my best interest at heart. And I had a very linear way, a very fleshly way of looking at that. And when I went through my divorce, it was almost like, "God, where were you?" And there was two things that really gave me a huge amount of revelation to deliver me from that season of a crushed spirit. At that time, because I had saved myself for marriage and all of that stuff, I was like, "Well, God, your way doesn't work. I'm going to try it my own way. I'm going to see what all the hype is about, you know, what's in the world." And I spent a year and a half looking for intimacy, but only finding perverted versions of it and cheap imitations of it because that's all that's out there in the world. So I was drinking, partying, trying to get external validation from women. And the crazy thing is, even when I got what I was looking for, I was still left so empty because I would have to go home and look in the mirror and still have to deal with myself. And that was a terrible feeling because the only way I can describe that is that I was losing everything by chasing nothing. What is it to gain the world but lose your soul? And so those two revelations were, number one, I was working out a lot at that time. And it was, you can do the right thing for the wrong reasons and absolutely get the wrong result. And that's what I was doing. I was working out because I didn't feel I was worthy of love. So if I looked a certain way, then I'd be worthy of love and validation and all these different things. But what I learned at that time is if you're working out in the gym, you don't get stronger in the gym. You actually get weaker. You're breaking down your muscle fibers to failure. It's not until the 2-3 days after that you put the right amount of water, sleep, carbs, and protein into your body that they grow back stronger. But what I realized was that if God made our bodies in that way, how much more so did he make our spirits that way? In other words, when we have parts of our character or spirit or heart that are deconstructed, that's not for our destruction. Rather, it's for our reconstruction because that is how he designed every aspect of us. But the second thing that really changed everything was that I had taken my pain and used it as an excuse to be prideful. See, Jesus, as we know, was God in the flesh. He had full authority of heaven. He claimed none of it. But you know what? Jesus went through betrayal, abandonment, loneliness, anguish. He went through physical, mental, emotional, and even spiritual torture beyond comprehension. But Jesus was perfect. So my mindset at that time that I realized was so toxic was, so Jesus was God in the flesh and he deserved to go through what he went through. But as imperfect as I am, I didn't deserve to go through what I went through. In other words, I realized that I was really being very prideful and that I don't serve the God of sympathy that wonders what it feels like for me to feel bad. Rather, anything that I experience in life, that not only did he go there, but he went there first. And he didn't have to. It makes me think of Lazarus, that, you know, that verse in scripture that says that Jesus wept, the shortest verse in scripture. That's such a profound verse because Jesus had announced twice at that time that he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead, yet he chose to weep. Why? Because his friends' hearts were so broken. And he chose to empathize with them because he doesn't wonder what our pain feels like. Rather, he actually feels it. And I realized I can serve a God like that. I can follow a God like that. Yep. He chose to opt into what we feel. And so that was the mindset and the heart set that I was purified from, that everything that happened to me was actually happening for me. In other words, I learned that the key to a crushed spirit is having your faith attached to outcomes. Because if you don't get the outcome you want, then that's a weak foundation. And so when my grandmother's building just pancake collapsed in the middle of the night, there was 101 people on June 24th, 2021 that went down with the building. And 3 of them were pulled out alive and survived. The other 98 died, my grandmother being one of them. And I'll just never forget walking up and seeing what I saw.
How'd you find out? Did you get a phone call in the middle of the night, or how did that play out? Take us back to that night.
So there was a woman by the name of Susanna Alvarez that lived in the building, the part of the building that did not collapse. So about 55 units, a third of the building was what went down. And then the other, you know, the remaining rest of the building was still standing. She was in the part that didn't go down. And everybody that was in the building that didn't collapse describes it as a loud thunder and an earthquake that completely rocked the whole building. When Susanna woke up and was shaken out of bed and she went out her front door, she didn't know what was going on. So she went out into the hallway to see what was going on. And when she went around the side after walking down her front door, she looked out and saw the stars, the ocean, and looked down where there used to be a hallway and heard people screaming from below. Susanna, her parents were best friends with my grandparents. So I don't know if it was in that exact moment or if it was a few minutes later, but somewhere in there, she called up my father in a state of hysterics saying, "The building is gone. Your mother's building is gone." And she woke up my father probably up. The collapse happened at 1:22 a.m. My father jumped out of bed and started rushing to Surfside. My mother called me probably at 1:30 and said, "Hey, your father just got this phone call. Your brother," which my brother's a first responder also, "he's on his way to pick me up, and then we're going to go pick you up. We're going to Surfside." So I'm like, "What happened?" She said, "I don't know. Something about an explosion in the building." And I'm like, "What? An explosion in the building?"
So I know. What a phone call for your dad. The building's gone. He's got to be like, "What are you talking about?"
I mean, my mom's like, "We're going to be there soon. Be ready." I'm like, "Okay." I hang up with her. I call the Surfside Police Department. I'm like, "Hey, I just got this phone call. What in the world's happening over there?" They're like, "Well, we can't really tell you. The situation is still developing." I said, "Well, it's 1:30 in the morning. I mean, should I be heading over there in the middle of the night?" And I'll never forget that police officer on the other end of the line said, "Yeah, you should get down here immediately." And that put the fear of God in me. When we arrived, me, my mom, and my brother, my dad had already been there. My dad had been on the phone with us the entire car ride in silence. He wouldn't say anything over the phone. All we could hear is just him weeping, and he wouldn't respond to questions, just nothing. He was in a state of shock. I think the thing that really messed with my head, when we arrived where my grandmother's building was on 88th and Collins, that street, 88th, separates the city of Miami Beach from Surfside. So there was a whole small sea of police officers and firefighters when we arrived, and we couldn't park on the Surfside side, so we parked in the Miami Beach side. My grandmother's building faced the north side. We had parked on the south side in Miami Beach. So as we walked up, all we saw was the building that hadn't collapsed. So I remember walking up thinking to myself, what was my father talking about? The building is right here. There's no smoke. There's no fire. And I had the sense of relief until I walked to the other side, the north end of the building, and saw that my grandmother's building was completely gone. Completely gone. We know now that the first six stories of the building, like when you look at pictures of the collapse after it happened, like if you look at my book cover, all you can see is all that rubble is the top half of the building. The first half of the building is actually in the parking garage. And so my grandmother's building was on the sixth floor. There was 12 stories. So my grandmother's balcony was right there in the middle of it. And so when we walked up, the first thing we saw was my grandmother's mangled balcony with her furniture thrown around.
Oh my gosh. Dang, and, what a visual that you'll never get out of your head.
Never.
I hope this isn't an insensitive question, but obviously for a level of human closure, were y'all able to get some remains?
The answer is yes. And that's a very relevant question because that first full day we were there, the forensic officers asked for a sample of my father's blood for DNA. And there were families that there was never a body found because their body was smashed beyond recognition. For some families, the only thing that was found was a tooth or a bone, a blood splatter. And they had to use the family's DNA that they collected to match it with the DNA of the person that was not even a person anymore. It was just the remains. Fortunately for my grandmother, I'm going to answer this question.
Yeah.
But first, I'm going to continue through my story because it's a beautiful progressive story, actually, in you asking that question that you did. So when I arrived to the scene, I had just fallen to my knees because there are situations that we're going to run into in life in which no man can save you, that the only first responder that can show up and rescue us is the name of Jesus himself. And I just fell to my knees. I just started crying out to God. God, what happened? You ever have a dream that's so real that when you wake up, you have to convince yourself like, oh my gosh, that was a dream, but it felt so real. And you know, you have to calm down. And then you realize, oh, thank God. Okay. It was just a dream. I was probably in a state of shock for about 30 minutes, maybe 45 minutes where I was just like, this has to be a dream. This had to have been, if it wasn't a dream, this had to have been a planned demolition that my grandmother forgot to tell us about. And so she was removed from the building along with the other residents. And then the demolition happened. There's no way that there was people in the building when this happened. And obviously, as we know now, there was. After the initial shock wore off that, you know, this was real, this was my new reality, there was a building right next door. It just felt like I was on hell on earth. My father, who was the chief of police for the city of Miami Beach, he'd worked there for 30 years, and now he's the police chief of a small town in Miami called North Bay Village. You know, my father's a very strong man. He has a kind of a stoic personality. So I've really never seen my father cry, maybe once or twice, but definitely not publicly. My father was weeping publicly. I mean, that in and of itself rocked me so much. Yeah,
that changes your life, seeing that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had to walk to the building next door and just, I sat down under the entranceway, put my AirPods in, and I started listening to a song that VU Worship had done called Shelter In. And it's basically all the promises of Psalm 91, that God is our refuge and our strength, and that we won't fear the terror of night, that 1,000 may fall to my left, 10,000 more to my right, but that God is my refuge and my strength. So as I'm listening to the song over and over and over, it was just such an epiphany of how the very thing that my grandmother trusted to shelter her in was probably the very thing that had killed her. And I think that's so true of how, I think it's a picture of when we put our faith into anything that's in this world, it's a weak foundation. It's not going to last. And so as I'm continuing to listen to the song and I'm praying, I'll never forget that it was the Holy Spirit that spoke to my heart and said, son, your grandmother, Kima, she loved me so much. Her life was from an overflow of my love. If her body is alive underneath that rubble, my presence is with her soul right now, sustaining her. And I have the power to do the miracle and to rescue her so that her story can be shared for my glory. But if her body is underneath that rubble, but her soul is not, it's because her soul is in my presence and she's already run into my arms. Either way, she's in my presence. Do you trust me with either outcome? And that revelation is what started to give me peace. And that revelation did change my life, because my father came to me and said, hey, the news is going to talk about this story, whether or not we want them to, but it's not their story to tell. It's our story. And that really, that what I just mentioned became my anthem just all over the world about my grandmother's story, and how, not how she died, because we didn't know if she had died yet, but of how she lived. Fast forward, now completing the question that you asked me, they find her whole body intact. My grandmother was the 12th person found 6 days later. And homicide detectives, when they called my father, we knew that when we were going to the family reunification center down the street, that we were about to get the official news that they had found and recovered her body, because had she been found alive, it wouldn't have been homicide detectives. It would have been hospital or fire rescue. When we were in this living room type space, the homicide detectives gave us the news, and my whole family started weeping. I was the only one that wasn't weeping, because I was dealing with so much anger in my heart that I just felt that I hadn't earned the right to mourn yet, which is a whole other story. But once everybody calmed down, the homicide detectives addressed my father and they said, we want you to know that when we recovered your mother's body, that we found this on her. And they handed my father a brown paper bag. Instantly, it became like this holy moment, because that first day that we were there at the collapse site, when the building fell, it was about 14 million pounds of just cement and metal, and the sheer velocity of all of that blew out a lot of the contents from the building. So that first day we were there, there was ties, there were shirts, bills, pictures. There was just kind of all different random belongings on the street. The first thing that we had found of my grandmother's was a birthday card that had been given to her by her prayer group 2 weeks prior. So we'd found that. And then once we found that, our mindset was, well, what else could be here? So we found two pictures of family, of both my grandparents in their younger years. And if you can believe this, we found a certificate that had been given to my grandmother by her church that said, God bless this house. And I have a picture of that certificate with the collapse site behind it. It's so surreal. So I had been talking about how my grandmother lived for her faith, her family, and her friends in that order. So when we opened up that brown paper bag, it revealed 6 rosaries inside of there. And the significance of that is I personally don't use rosaries to pray. There's no personal significance for me, but my grandmother would use them. And there were so many beautiful full circle moments when it was revealed that those were rosaries within the bag. The first reason being that my grandmother went to sleep that night and woke up in heaven. Her last act on earth was in prayer. And then she opened up her eyes and she was in front of Jesus. That's such a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
But the second thing was that God was so good. He was so faithful that the way that the Lord chose to seal that moment, that time of our life that we were in, was I'd been talking about how my grandmother lived for her faith, family, and friends. And that birthday card symbolized her friendships. That the 2 pictures of family represented family, but the rosary symbolized her faith. And it was almost like God saying, son, your grandmother's legacy is now sealed. Mark Batterson says it this way. He says that an inheritance is what you leave behind for someone, but a legacy is what you leave behind in someone. And my grandmother's legacy was love, because she truly lived with a childlike faith to where it truly was from a place of overflow. How can your well of love run dry when it comes from this place of an endless supply, which is Jesus? And so it was total and complete closure within that moment. And she was one of the few people that they had found and recovered her entire body. And so I felt like God looked out for us in so many different ways, and he brought us comfort in ways we would never imagine.
In a condition that was recognizable?
Fully intact.
Golly, that's incredible.
Yeah, fully intact.
And you so said how many people were found like that? You said how many? Was she?
I don't know what the number is, but I knew that, I mean, there was people that weren't found till after a month later.
Yeah.
You know, just imagine just with the decomposition over that time frame. So my father, after I mentioned that about the rosaries and what they meant, my father lowered his head. And I'd been praying over my father for a long time before this. My dad lowered his head. He said, guys, I don't know how we're going to get through this. All I know is I can't get through this without God helping us. And he started praying, God, I believe in you, the Father. Jesus, I believe in you, the Son. Holy Spirit, I believe in you and I ask you into my heart, because without you showing up, I don't know how we're going to get through this. And my interpretation of that was that my grandmother's death had saved my father's life.
Which, going back to the beginning of the conversation and how you used to read Romans 8:28, you are living the true meaning of Romans 8:28, that it's not a preventance of bad things happening, but it's a promise that, hey, whatever does happen, no matter how horrible, I will bring good out of it.
Absolutely. Yes.
Golly. But before we move on to, because I want to hear more of your spiritual resolve and what God's done in your heart and your book and all of that, but I am curious, because I'm not really informed about this collapse. Like, what do they say is the cause? Are there major lawsuits? Where do we stand with that building? What happened?
That's a very loaded question. So I'll try to answer it as quickly as possible. The short answer on the reason for the collapse is it's still under investigation. What I believe, the first thing that collapsed at 1:15 a.m. was the pool area. And there are all kinds of reports that talk about how that whole entire area was very corroded. A very important fact in all of this is that my grandmother's building had just gone through a 40-year recertification process. So it had just had an entire inspection, like from top to bottom. And there was millions of dollars of work that needed to be done in it. So I remember the way that my family and I found out is, you know, my grandmother was the oldest one in the building. Kima was 92 years old. And although she had the energy of a teenager and the social life of a prom queen, and I mean, she lived on her own.
And what was her name again?
She was a young soul. Well, her name was Hilda.
Hilda.
But since I was a child, called her Kima.
Kima?
Yeah.
Nice. Is there any significance to Kima?
I think when I was a baby or a toddler, I was trying to say,
yeah,
you know, grandma, and it just came out, Kima.
I love,
you know?
That. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
I'm sure that's how tons of grandparents' names have been formed. It's the little kid trying to say it.
Well, it took a life of its own because even my own father, you know, her son refers to his own mother as Kima. You know, it became a beautiful term of endearment. But I'll never forget that one day we found out that, you know, my grandmother had her condo paid off. The condo association fees were about $900 a month. And on top of that, one day she owed $100,000. In addition to that, because I think it was a $15 million assessment that was divided up among the 136 units that were in the building. And so we were like, this is crazy. This thing has paid off. So my grandmother's apartment was for sale. My sister who's a realtor, was in the building earlier that day showing the apartment to another family.
Gosh.
And, you know, now I have a little nephew, you know, her and her husband, you know, had him a year later, you know, to think I could have lost my sister and her husband and my future nephew is a scary thought. But, yeah, I believe what happened from all these reports I've read for the 40-year certification process is, there was leaks from within the foundations that where salt water was actually leaking in because it's a beachfront property. So it was on the ocean. And over four decades, what was happening is that concrete was absorbing that salt water. And then in the concrete was the metal skeleton, the rebar. And so that rebar was rusting out over years. And eventually it just expanded and expanded and expanded until it blew out the concrete, leading to the collapse of the whole building. That's not the official report, but from everything I've gathered, that's the most logical thing that they will come out with. As far as settlements, that is one of the most interesting aspects of this. Judge Michael Handsman, who presided over the whole thing, he within, I think it was 10 months, had everything settled. When we started the process, there was $48 million of insurance on the entire building. But so if you divide that between 136 units, it was like $330 million per family. I mean, or not per family, per unit. That's nothing. That wasn't even half of the value of each unit. So Judge Handsman, and with all of the lawsuits that took place, that $48 million grew to over $1 billion and settled within less than a year's time. And
so you said $330,000 was what was allotted?
Well, just from the insurance, if you would have taken $48 million measly. Divided it by 136.
Yeah, that's measly. Yeah, okay. I thought you said $330 million for a second. I was like, whoa. But yeah, $330,000, no. Yeah, okay.
So the way that Judge Handsman presided over that, I mean, these lawsuits that took place, you know, I think in any other courtroom probably would have taken 5 to 10 years. Like you don't even have car accident lawsuits that settle in less than a year, let alone something this big. But I think within 10 months, it was settled.
Yeah. Man, there's so much here, Mike. Like when you said at the beginning of the story, you know, walking up and there's moments where only Jesus, I mean, that almost broke me. And then the story before that, it sounds such like a beautiful prodigal son story of you trying to find any way of figuring out life and helping your pain and doing things your own way and coming home to the apartment. I thought of the prodigal son who was, you know, eating with the pigs because you would come home and still not be settled. Gosh, man, this has got to be an awesome book. So The Uncollapsible Soul, How Do You Endure a Broken Heart Without Crushing Your Spirit? When were you thinking, man, I need to write a book?
So what made me want to write the book was I kept seeing Psalm 34:18 throughout the entire process of everything that had to do with Surfside. I mean, even... So across the street from the collapse site, there was this tennis court that was a block long. And along the fence that was one block long, it became known as the Wall of Hope, where there was pictures of those that were missing. There was flowers and personal belongings. It became like a prayer wall. And people would just go there to mourn and cry right across the street from the collapse site. But in the middle of that fence was Psalm 34:18, and it kept showing up. And for those that don't know, Psalm 34:18 says that the Lord is near to the brokenhearted and he rescues those that are crushed in spirit. And it just hit me one day that the Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He doesn't rescue the brokenhearted, but he wants to rescue those that are crushed in spirit. These two things must be completely different. And what I realized is that a broken heart is a season of grieving that none of us can avoid. If you're going to go through this life, you will go through loss, and there's going to be a grief process attached to that. But a crushed spirit is something entirely different. A crushed spirit is losing your faith, your hope, and your purpose. It means you're like a well without water or a bird without wings, where you just don't feel like you have any purpose in your existence. And so it just hit me one day of how can you allow things to break your heart without them breaking your spirit?
That's huge, man. That is really insightful. Because, you know, a lot of times when people are in pain and me as a pastor and they come to me, I rarely pray for their pain to go away, because that is a part of the human experience. I mean, we in this life, we will have trouble, you know, we will have pain, but for there to be peace amidst the pain. So a broken heart, yes, that's what we will have, but a crushed spirit seems to be lacking peace, lacking any sense of hope because you're crushed. I like that distinction.
Yes, absolutely. So what led me to writing the book was so many different things. One of them is that I wanted to honor my grandmother's legacy. I wanted something to live on way beyond my grandmother or myself. The second thing that led me to writing the book is I got introduced to so many other Surfside families way after everything happened. And as I got to know them, as I got to know their stories, it rocked me to my core, because I think as Christians, we always say there's a difference between knowing about God and knowing God. I think there's a huge difference between knowing about someone from the news and actually getting to know them and their story personally.
Sure.
And learning their stories, it just rocked me. It made me realize that my grandmother's story is not the only story to tell. And I learned so much from each family that taught me a lesson in healing. I'll just share one of them.
Yeah, that's funny, because I was about to ask you, can you share one? You beat me to it.
Yeah. So when the building collapsed, there was this 15-year-old teenager named Jonah Handler that was sitting on his bed in his room with his mom, Stacy Feng. When the building collapsed, they both went down with the building and survived the fall. When the building was freshly collapsed, there was a guy walking by that was walking his dog. You know, he saw the building collapse. And I guess once the dust subsided and everything, he got close enough and heard Jonah crying for help. Jonah was the first person rescued out of the rubble alive. Jonah's rescue went viral all over the media because it was actually captured. His mom was also found alive, but her leg was actually pinned underneath the rubble. They couldn't get her out. In an effort to save her life, they had to do an amputation right on the spot. And I want you to think about that. It's not like they're prepping you for surgery and they're numbing you up and putting you to sleep. I mean, this is, if we don't get this person out of here, they're going to die. And so they did an amputation on the spot, and his mom ended up dying just before getting to the hospital. Mm. Then I'm going to skip to another story. There's Raquel Oliveira that was initially going to fly out on June 24th, the day of the collapse, to Colorado. Because the airline ticket was a few dollars cheaper, she actually flew out the day before, Wednesday, June 23rd. She left her 5-year-old son and her husband, who were going to meet her in a few days. She was going to visit her mom and her sister in Colorado. And that night, she lost her 5-year-old son and her husband. She lost her entire world overnight. The reason I share both their stories is about 10 months after the collapse, I had built a relationship with Jonah's dad, Neil, because Jonah's dad brought purpose to the pain and actually started a nonprofit organization to help first responders get the healing and mental health resources that they need to, because first responders are often not thought of as victims themselves. But the truth is that they got to bring that stuff home with them. You know, the things they see every day, especially something like that. So I had already been building a relationship with Jonah's dad, Neil, over the phone. I met Neil, his son Jonah, for pizza, and he invited Raquel. Now, I had never met Raquel up to this point, But I was so mesmerized by Raquel's story that as I'm listening to this woman that literally lost her entire world. And I think 3 hours went by that I'm sitting there in conversation and the lights in the restaurant are like shutting off around us. I hadn't even ordered. I was so captivated listening to her. And there was this beautiful moment I'll never forget about, and I write about it in my book, that Jonah got up to go to the bathroom and Raquel was looking at Neil, Jonah's dad, and said, "You have no idea how blessed you are to have your son." And Jonah walks back and she lovingly and jokingly looks at Jonah and says, "If your dad ever gives you too hard of a time, you know that I'll take care of you, right?" Now, for me, watching this take place, I don't even think they realized what was happening in that moment. Raquel had lost her son and her husband. And here she had Jonah and his dad that symbolized a manifestation of everything that she had lost. Jonah had Raquel there, who was being this motherly, nurturing figure to him, symbolizing his mom that he had lost. And in watching that moment, it was so beautiful because it made me realize that we need each other. Even Jesus walked the earth with 12 disciples. Jesus didn't try to do this on his own. One of the biggest tactics of the enemy is isolation. Isolation is not solitude. Isolation is being a victim. It's going into hiding, not allowing anybody to have access to you, and there's not a predetermined amount of time to it. But solitude is going into hiding for a purpose, for healing, prayer, you know, meditation to clear your thoughts, spending time with God. And there's a specific timeline attached to it. And one of the lies of the enemy is to trick you that you need to go into isolation. And seeing Raquel and Jonah and Neil in that moment was such a beautiful picture about how when we get together and share our pain, it doesn't multiply the pain. It multiplies the love. There's healing that takes place. You can think of it this way. A candle loses nothing by lighting another candle. And that's what we're called to be, that we're all called to be a light into the night. Because one of the lessons that I have learned through this process is that a byproduct of suffering is passion. How do you know if you're passionate about something, you're willing to suffer for it? If you're not willing to suffer for it, then by default, you're not passionate about it. Now, something that's never talked about is that passion is neutral, because healing has to be intentional. There's a lie that the world teaches, which is that all things heal with pain. No, all things get buried with pain. And if you don't face your past will eventually face you. The truth about passion is if you don't focus your passion towards healing, it won't lead towards restoration. Rather, that passion will lead towards resentment. And resentment that is passionate manifests as bitterness in our lives. But if that passion is rooted in restoration, the byproduct of that will be healing. And when we're healed, not only does the word promise to bring joy from our sorrow, but one of the other byproducts is bringing purpose to our pain. How do you find purpose in your pain? Because you're healed and you become passionate about helping other people to find their healing. In other words, it's no longer about you. And that's how I've seen Romans 8:28, where God works all things for the good of those that love him, come to be very true in my life.
Yeah. And people who read this book will hear about 5 requisites of restoration: revealing it, relieving it, releasing it, reframing it, and renewing it. I want to ask you about the last 2, and then we can wrap it up there. But reframing it, renaming it, what does that look like? What you just said?
If you don't mind, I'll just touch each one. Sure. And get through all of them in a minute or two, because they're actually all progressive. The first one, I think that Jesus spoke to us in parables because our minds were not designed to think in words. They were designed to think in pictures, very similar to a movie. And so the picture I want to give everybody listening is, instead of an emotional wound, imagine you're in the kitchen cutting a tomato or something and you accidentally slice right through your hand. These 5 requisites to restoration are very true of physical healing as they are of emotional healing. So the first thing you have to do when you're wounded is you have to acknowledge your pain. The way I write about it in the book is you have to reveal it. You have to recognize your heartbreak. I mean, that sounds like it's common sense, but there's so many people that never heal because they don't acknowledge the pain. They bury the pain, like I mentioned before. So once you recognize it, the next step is you have to respond to your pain. And when you respond to it, now you're relieving it because you're addressing the pain. So maybe what you're doing is you're washing that wound with soap and water. Maybe you're putting a towel on it to stop the bleeding. But the next step to responding to that wound is now you have to relinquish your anguish, which is surrendering your pain. Maybe you need stitches. Maybe you need surgery to repair some tendons in your hand where you cut yourself. So what do you need to do? You need to go to an urgent care. You need to go to a hospital. You need to surrender to the care of a professional that can help you, even if it hurts. One reason that a lot of people avoid the process of healing is healing hurts, but healing is also worth the hurt. And then that leads us to step number four is you have to reframe it. You have to rename your pain. See, what eventually happens is once you surrender your pain and you go through that healing process, what was once a wound will become a scar. And when you have scar tissue, that scar tissue can no longer bleed. It can no longer get infected. That skin is thicker than the skin that was once there. So it's more calloused. But that scar also tells a story of strength, a story of triumph that somebody else needs to hear. So you have to rename your pain from a wound to a scar, because that's what God has called us to do in our own stories as well. And then the fifth step is you have to redeem your sorrow, which that means you have to draw purpose from your pain. When you redeem something, like let's say you redeem a coupon, you are trading that coupon for value. Well, again, the word promises that the Lord will redeem our tears of sorrow for joy. And there's such a beauty to that, because when God brings purpose to our pain, it no longer becomes about our own healing. It becomes about other people's. And that for me is ultimately why I wrote the book. It's because I had to go through my own process of healing and restoration. I was a mess following the collapse. There was a point I was seeing a Christian counselor and a psychologist at the exact same time. And I went through my own process of healing. And once I went through it, I realized, oh my gosh, there's five things that I did. And I just put language to it. And so I just pray that these five requisites to restoration ultimately help each and every single person that reads my book. Because the truth is that every person's soul was meant to be uncollapsible. When you can go through things that'll break your heart, well, if as long as you're focused on trusting God through that healing process, your spirit will never be crushed. And as long as you allow things to break your heart without breaking your spirit, that's how you make your soul uncollapsible.
Mike, this is wonderful stuff. You have walked through the fire and you've got a story to tell, man. So definitely we will have the information for your book, but thank you so much for sharing Kima with us and your story. Tell us a couple more things about your grandma before we wrap it up.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's very paramount to my relationship with my grandmother is my dad's sister, her only daughter, she died in a car accident about 6 months after I was born. So all that love, affection, adoration, and passion that she had for her daughter, she poured into me. And my grandmother used to say something my entire life. She would look at me with just love in her eyes. And she would say, "You saved my life." And I never knew what she meant until she was gone. Now I get it. But my grandmother, man, she was 92, but she had the soul of somebody that was in their 50s. I mean, she had so much energy. She loved to cook. Nothing made her happier than getting family together and doing, you know, Sunday lunches and going out to dinner. She had a huge sweet tooth. I'll never forget. One time she was hanging out at my parents' place and she was like, "Hey, my doctor said I can't have any more sugar." And then later in the kitchen, she found her rummaging for desserts. And I go, "Kima, I thought the doctor said no more sugar." She said, "He said a little bit." She was just such a sweetheart. I'm so grateful for her life, because if everybody was a little more like Kima, the world would be a much better place, because there was an innocence. There was a childlike faith that she had. You know, also tying in what I mentioned earlier, I realize now that when I went through my divorce, what it taught me is that that was actually preparation to detach my faith to outcomes and attach my faith only to Jesus, regardless of the outcome. What I once called a curse in one season, I actually now call a blessing because I see now that God was actually preparing me for everything that was coming from Surfside. So I'm so thankful for my grandmother's life and the gift that chemo was to me and my family and everybody that knew her. And I'm just so thankful for you having me on this podcast. And I just pray that this just blesses at least one person.
It already affected one person. How about that?
I love that.
Hey, but we'll air it for others too. I'm not going to be selfish. Let's go.
Thanks for listening. There's a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook page where we talk about these episodes and share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests we're booking. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.